Okay, as we've been looking through this book of Esther over these few weeks, we've been exploring some various themes. The difference between God and the Persian king of Xerxes. The faithfulness of God, the sovereignty of God, and how he's working out his plan to rescue his people, how he's guiding history. And tonight we're going to be tying some of these themes together as we look at the edict in chapter 8. So, a quick recap of what's happened so far in the story. We've got Esther. Esther's a young Jewish girl. She's been forcibly, perhaps, brought into the king's harem. She rises to the position of the queen. And there's this plot which is thought up by one of the king's closest men, one of his closest advisors, to destroy the Jews, to destroy the people of God. And through the counsel of Mordecai, who's Esther's cousin, he advises her to approach the king, reveal her identity, plead for her life and that of her people. A very risky business, as we found out a few weeks ago. She does this, and the king is furious at what has been revealed. Possibly, partly because of his own stupidity in allowing this thing to go through. He blindly accepted what Haman offered to him. And so he executes Haman. And it talks about his wrath subsiding when he executes Haman. However, the decree which was sent out by Haman to all the provinces is still in effect. It's still in effect at this point. That on the 13th day of the 12th month, final month, 13th day, the Jews would be annihilated. The Jews would be wiped out, both young and old, men and women and their children. And their goods are going to be plundered. This is the edict which has been sent out. And according to the law of the Medes and the Persians, the decree of the king cannot be altered. If it's written in the king's name, if it's been sealed, it cannot be altered. So what's going to happen to the Jewish population now? That's where we're going to pick up our story this evening. Just something for you to be aware of. And if you've got the handout, it tells you a bit about the translation notes. For verse 11 in this, I'm going to be using the alternative translation that's in the footnotes of the 2011 NIV translation. I'll explain the reason why for that in a bit. But if you think, hang on, this isn't what it's saying in the church Bible here, that's why. I'm going to have a look at Esther chapter 8. Esther 8, starting at verse 1, and that's on page 506 in the church Bibles. That same day, King Xerxes gave Queen Esther the estate of Haman, the enemy of the Jews. And Mordecai came into the presence of the king. For Esther had told how he was related to her. The king took off his signet ring, which he reclaimed from Haman, and presented it to Mordecai. And Esther appointed him over Haman's estate. Esther again pleaded with the king, falling at his feet and weeping. She begged him to put an end to the evil plan of Haman, the Agagite, which he devised against the Jews. Then the king extended the golden scepter to Esther, and she arose and stood before him. If it pleases the king, she said, and if he regards me with favor and thinks it the right thing to do, and if he is pleased with me, let an order be written overruling the dispatches that Haman, son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, devised and wrote to destroy the Jews in all the king's provinces. For how can I bear to see disaster fall on my people? How can I bear to see the destruction of my family? King Xerxes replied to Esther and to Mordecai the Jew. Because Haman attacked the Jews, I have given his estate to Esther, and they have hanged him on the gallows. Now write another decree in the king's name, in behalf of the Jews, as seems best to you, and seal it with the king's signet ring. For no document written in the king's name and sealed with his ring can be revoked. At once the royal secretaries were summoned. On the 23rd day of the third month, the month of Sivan, they wrote out all of Mordecai's orders to the Jews, and the satraps, governors, and nobles of the 127 provinces stretching from India to Kush. These orders were written in the scripts of each province and the language of each people, and also to the Jews in their own scripts and language. Mordecai wrote in the name of King Xerxes, sealed the dispatches with the king's signet ring, and sent them by mounted couriers who rode fast horses, especially bred for the king. The king's edict granted the Jews in every city the right to assemble and protect themselves, to destroy, kill, and annihilate any armed force of any nationality or province, together with their women and children who might attack them, and to plunder the property of their enemies. The day appointed for the Jews to do this in all the provinces of King Xerxes was the 13th day of the 12th month, the month of Adar. A copy of the text of the edict was to be issued as a law in every province and made known to the people of every nationality, so the Jews would be ready on that day to avenge themselves on their enemies. The couriers riding royal horses raced out, spurred on by the king's command, and the edict was also issued in the citadel of Susa. Mordecai left the king's presence, wearing royal garments of blue and white, a large crown of gold and a purple robe of fine linen, and the city of Susa held a joyous celebration. For the Jews it was a time of happiness and joy, gladness and honor. In every province and in every city, wherever the edict of the king went, there was joy and gladness among the Jews, with feasting and celebrating. And many people of other nationalities became Jews because the fear of the Jews had seized them. So this translation, which slightly changed in verse 11, to annihilate those who attack them together with their women and children, it's a lot harsher than the standard NIV rendering, but it's more accurate to the Hebrew. It fits the parallelism, which we're going to look at shortly, between the decree of Mordecai and the decree earlier of Haman. And in these instances, I often think sometimes it's wiser to take a more simplistic reading of the text, even if it's more difficult to accept, and then at least seek to grapple with those issues than just sweeping them under the carpet. So that's what we're going to seek to do tonight. The implications of this verse we're going to explore a bit later, but first I wanted to look at this theme, the theme of role reversal. So the theme of role reversal. The parallels which we have here between chapter 8 and chapter 3, they're pretty much unmistakable, and you've got these on one of your handouts if you grabbed one when you came in. If not, there are spare ones at the back. So first, Haman, he makes a decree in the name of the king that the Jews, they're to be annihilated with their women, their children, and their goods are to be plundered. It's sealed with a signet ring of the king, and the decree sent out into all the provinces of the king. And whilst Haman celebrates, the city of Susa is in confusion and tumult. Now, the decree of Haman, on the one side, and then we've got the decree of Mordecai, which is really a complete undoing of this decree of Haman. This time, it's those who attack the Jews who are to be annihilated and to be plundered, along with their women and their children. Again, it's sealed with the king's signet ring. It goes out into all the provinces of the king, but this time there's joy in the city of Susa. Those who had purposed in their heart to set themselves against God, to destroy his people, are now themselves going to be destroyed. And one of the interesting things about these decrees is the time span between Haman's decree and Mordecai's decree. See, Haman's decree, it was sent out on the 13th day of the first month. Mordecai's edict, it's sent out on the 23rd day of the third month. We have a time lapse here of 70 days. And that's another parallel that I just want us to consider as well. I don't think there's no accident of history here that we can see parallels between what we read of in Esther and the events of the exile. I don't think it's an accident. We see parallels between the events of the exile and what we're reading about in Esther. Now, Babylon, the power which was used to send the land of Judah into exile, used by God initially to chastise his people, but had risen up against God. In her pride, had set herself against the Lord Almighty. In a similar way to Haman. In a similar way to Haman as well, whilst both of them are feasting in their own pride, celebrating their own exaltation, judgment comes. Judgment's brought upon Babylon. If you read the passages in the book of Daniel. And Babylon is overthrown that very night when the handwriting appears on the wall. When they're celebrating. Haman is overthrown in one day. And there's a period of 70 years between the exile of Judah and their return. Just as the 70 days between the edict of Haman and that of Mordecai. In both instances here, we see God's restoration of his people. We see his deliverance of his people. And the deliverance of God's people in Persia is just as certain as the deliverance in the exile. And perhaps that's what God was wanting the people to see. The deliverance for the people in Persia was just as certain as a return from exile. Because as you may remember, the name of God is not explicitly mentioned anywhere in the book of Esther, either by his divine name Yahweh or the term God. And so we were posed perhaps with this question as we were looking through this, but has God cast off his people? Has he forgotten them? Has he moved on away? Although people may be unfaithful to God, God's never unfaithful. Because he cannot be untrue to himself. People may be unfaithful to God, but God is not unfaithful because he cannot be untrue to himself. And we see this theme of judgment and restoration going throughout the Bible as God fights against his enemy. And it's important for us to remember this. The question is less, is God on my side in these instances, but more, am I on God's side? Not, is God on my side, but am I on God's side? And as Paul took us through chapter 4 a few weeks ago, we saw in the book of Esther this time of fasting, this time of repentance as they were turning to God, as they were crying out to God, which occurs both in the exile and both in the story of Esther. For both of them, it's about them turning to God. Even though they're in exile, they're not cut off from the grace of God. God's not automatically on their side. It's about turning to God. Not getting God to turn around to our way of thinking, but of us turning to God. And that's very important for us to consider as we look through this concept. The main thing that I want us to really think about tonight is this concept of holy war. Perhaps a controversial term, but I think we need to deal with these issues. So remember, we're not talking about is God on my side, but am I on God's side? Remember the phrase which we've been using in some of our youth-led services, that God is not a king like Xerxes. God is not a king like Xerxes. See, Xerxes was a reactionary king. He was perhaps a little more than a power base. He was a rubber stamp. Didn't seem to have an original thought in the book of Esther. And his response in verse 7 of this chapter, chapter 8, verse 7, it could perhaps be more accurately translated along these lines of Haman saying, look, I've given Haman's property to Esther, and he's been hanged on the gallows because he's lifted his hand against the Jews. So basically, look, I've dealt with Haman. What else do you want me to do? I've dealt with Haman. I've done it. No, notice what Stephen said last week when Haman was hanged, the king's wrath subsided. He wasn't really bothered about the Jewish people. What do you want me to do? I've done my bit now. It's in your hands. You deal with it. You come up with a plan. You deal with it. I'll rubber stamp it. But holy war's not like that. It's not about us getting the power to destroy our enemies. It's about God defeating his enemies. It's not about getting a rubber stamp and a seal of approval. It's about God's initiative. And the complete annihilation of people groups, which we read about at points in the Old Testament, is not an easy thing to accept. I admit it, it's not an easy thing to accept. I don't always understand it. More often than not, I don't understand it. I don't always like it. I don't always feel comfortable with it. But I'm going to refuse to gloss over it. We can't just gloss over it. We must remember that it's about God bringing about his judgment on his enemies, though. It's not a mandate for us to just go ahead and attack those who we think are our enemies. And neither is it wise for us to blame ancient Israel for genocide and hatred. The complete annihilation of nations which we read about in the Old Testament, we can't just blame on Israel. This was God's command. It's God's judgment on his enemies. So if we've got an issue with it, we take it up with God. If you think you're more righteous than God, good luck, but take it up with him. And I don't always understand it. I don't always feel comfortable about it. But what I do know is that God's judgment is righteous. I might not be able to see it. I may not be able to understand it. But God's judgment is righteous. And sometimes I just have to leave it there. But let's have a look. Let's have a probe and see what it is that God is speaking to us and what he's speaking to us today. And as we look at verse 11 here, think back to what we heard in our earlier reading from 1 Samuel 15. And I want us to consider where King Saul failed. Because what we see in Esther chapter 8 is really a replay of 1 Samuel 15. So consider where Saul failed. Now, in this part of Scripture, the people, they turned away from looking to God as their deliverer and rescuer, and they requested that they have a king like all the other nations who could rescue and deliver them. So God gives them a king. He gives them what they want. He gives them Saul. And Saul is commanded by God to enact his judgment on the people of Amalek, a people who had set themselves against God, as we read about in Deuteronomy 25, verse 18. So God had called Saul to execute his judgment on the people of Amalek. God had decreed their complete and utter destruction. Wipe them out. As we read, Saul destroyed only what suited him. Only what suited him. He wasn't being merciful. He destroyed what only suited him. And Haman, it's believed, is a descendant of the Amalekites. King Agag. The one that Saul let get away. And Mordecai, you may have noticed, comes from exactly the same line of Saul. So perhaps this brings a new understanding to Mordecai's words to Esther earlier on. That if she fails to act, deliverance will come from elsewhere, but her household and her will be destroyed. See, Saul's disobedience led eventually to his own demise, to his own destruction, and it put the life of his people at peril years down the line when they're in Persia. Yet God had provided another rescue. There's another chance here. So the edict that's sent out in verse 11, it's not only an undoing of what Haman had written earlier, but it's also another chance for the people to fulfill that command which God had given to Saul. In the holy war against Amalek, it was God's judgment on his enemies. It was never intended as a quick profit-making opportunity for Saul or the people of Israel. They weren't to keep the plunder. It wasn't for them to get money from it. Wipe them out completely. Don't take the plunder. So perhaps it's not surprising that as they carry out this edict, and you'll find out more about this next week in chapter 9, they don't lay a hand on the plunder. They don't touch the plunder, the very thing that was forbidden by God and transgressed by Saul in the initial command. So we've considered how holy war is not against the enemies of Israel, it's against God's enemies. And I truly believe that Haman's hatred against the Jews was an expression, was an outworking of his hatred of God. It was a manifestation of his hatred of God. And in this, God was dealing with his enemies. But before we start pointing fingers at those who we think are the enemies of God, we need to consider not just where Saul failed, but where all of us have failed, where everyone has failed. Now, we can be prone to make overgeneralizations in life. I was guilty of doing sex this week regarding estate agents. But God doesn't make overgeneralizations. God doesn't make overgeneralizations. He knows everyone. He knows what we're like. So who has set themselves against God? We know that when God declares that all have turned away, that no one was on God's side, that we've all set ourselves up as his enemies. It's not like a little kid having a sulk in the playground saying, no one's my friend. This isn't an overgeneralization. This is the truth. This is a revelation from God. The whole of humanity set itself up against God. Poisoned and corrupted by sin. So much that sin and wickedness and rebellion has become part of humanity. That's why Jesus says the problem's with the human heart. It's with inside you. It's part of you. So when we talk about holy war, when we talk about God taking vengeance on his enemies, no, it was only through his mercy that he didn't completely annihilate and wipe out humankind in the first place. Israel included. Deuteronomy 9:5, God says to them, don't think that it's because of your righteousness. It's not because you're righteous that I've chosen you, that I'm bringing you into this land. You're stiff-necked. All people are in the same boat. And the whole reason that the Jews were in exile at this point is because their wickedness had surpassed the nations which God had initially driven out of the land. We can read about that in 2 Kings 21, 2, or Ezekiel 5, 7. See, no one was on God's side, not even the people he'd set apart. So he fought the war alone. Fought the war alone. Jesus Christ, the true obedient Israel, the roots of Jesse, the branch of David, he was the one who fought the war. The war was fought by him upon his own body on the cross as Jesus bore all of humanity's sin, all our sin, all our wickedness, that God's judgment was poured out on him. God was dealing with his enemies. God's wrath was directed at sin through Jesus Christ, that through Jesus Christ we may receive the forgiveness of God. We may receive the healing, the restoration. Judgment was poured out on sin through Jesus, that through Jesus the grace of God may be poured out on our lives. God's holy war had been fought. The victory had been sealed, as we read about in Colossians earlier on. God's enemies have been defeated. Remember Psalm 110. When David wrote, the Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand till I make your enemies your footstool. Now this wasn't a promise to David, the Lord said to my Lord. It wasn't a promise to David's son. It was a promise to David's Lord. It was a promise to Jesus Christ. And God will make his enemies his footstool. When Jesus returns, we know every knee will bow, every tongue will confess Jesus Christ is Lord, to the glory of God the Father. It's not for us to decide who God's enemies are. It's not for us to decide we're going to bring about God's judgment on them. As we've seen, it's the whole of humanity that set itself against God. But Jesus has won the holy war. Jesus has won the holy war. When we speak of holy war, Jesus has won it. Everything changed at the cross. Everything changed with the coming of Jesus Christ. And we must understand this. Every time we read the Bible, everything changed at the cross. We're living now in a completely different part of history. Everything's different. And we have to allow the gospel to interpret the scriptures. Otherwise we'll miss the point. We'll have a completely wrong understanding of God's dealing with the world. We have to have our eyes opened and the gospel to interpret the scriptures. Because just as Jesus, he had to rebuke James and John when they were with him and he was ministering. And they said, "Master, shall we call down fire on the Samaritans who have rejected you?" And Jesus had to rebuke them. Because everything has changed in the light of the cross. Because God has fought the war. He's won the war. His enemies have been defeated. And so for us today, what does that mean? What is God speaking to all of us tonight? You know, it can be very easy for us to listen to these things and think, yeah, well, you know what, I wish the medieval crusaders, I wish they'd thought about this a bit more. I can think of groups around the world who perhaps need to think about this, yeah. But maybe it doesn't affect me too much. Because, you know, by and large, I don't think in Virginia Water it's pretty high on people's agendas to go out and start invading and slaughtering people. Well, I hope not. I don't think it's pretty high on our agendas, really. Or is it? Now, in verse 17 of chapter 8, we read that many people became Jews because fear of the Jews fell upon them. So why did they become Jews? Because they had a holy and righteous fear of God? I don't think the text really suggests that. It's kind of highly unlikely. They seem to have converted mainly because the Jews were the governing and the political power at the time. They were the people with the clout. Sounds familiar, doesn't it, really? I've heard people bemoan the fact that the UK is no longer a Christian country. And I sometimes wonder if it ever really was. Because the adopted religion of the governing power doesn't make people Christians. It doesn't flow down from the government down to everyone else. Remember the opening of the Gospel of John. Those not born of the will of man, but they're born of God. And so when some people say, we must claim back this country for God, what do they mean? Well, I wish it was a genuine longing to see the kingdom of God established. Sometimes, though, I feel it's a desire for us to seek to create a Christian utopia. But we're not called to create our own version of heaven on earth where it's pleasant to live as a Christian, or it's easy to live as a Christian. That's not the purpose of God's kingdom growing, that we have an easy life. Or perhaps our intentions are in the right place. We want to see God's kingdom grow. We want to see God's kingdom established, but we've completely missed the point. We've come up with a plan. We've come up with our battle plan, and now we want God to bless it. God to place his rubber stamp on it. And as a result, we burn out. We alienate people. We fight battles on our own terms in the name of God. Now, we may not be like the medieval crusaders marching across Europe to the promised land, but we can very easily fall into that same trap. Remember, Holy War, it wasn't about Israel defeating her enemies. It wasn't even about Israel defeating God's enemies, because they failed at that. They made a right mess up of that. It was always about God defeating his enemies. Jesus Christ winning the Holy War. Holy War is not about getting God on side with our plans, but rather us getting on side with God. And it's good, I think, for us to remember this and to reflect on this fact and to think about, are our plans really our own? Or is this what God wants? Am I seeking to build God's kingdom, or am I allowing God to build his kingdom as he wants it through me? It's important that we remember that success isn't necessarily a measure of God's pleasure. Read about Moses and when he struck the rock. Success isn't a measure of God's pleasure. God's view of success is not like the world's. God is interested in faithfulness. He'll deal with everything else. And so that warning, which was given to Saul, still stands for us today. To obey is better than sacrifice. To obey is better than sacrifice. Doesn't matter how big your sacrifice is, obedience is better than sacrifice. See, if we seek to justify our actions by saying, you know what, I'm building God's kingdom. If we seek to justify ourselves using that phrase, then perhaps it's good for us to stop and think what it is that we're really building and why. Because God's kingdom, it wasn't ushered in through political might. It wasn't ushered in through military power. It wasn't ushered in by the wisdom or the strength or the cunning of man or by clever business, marketeering or anything like that. But it was brought in by the obedient sacrifice of Jesus Christ. And one final thing, and this isn't a preacher's final thing, this is a final thing. When I was preparing this talk, I was reminded of a picture I had one morning as I was waking. I'd been thinking about the spread of the gospel. And I saw this lake, and it was covered with all sorts of boats, from massive trawlers to smaller fishing boats. And they had all manner of gear, like radar, and some had massive nets, and some had fishing rods. But every single boat caught the same amount of fish. None. Not one. They didn't catch anything. And then I saw the same lake, with one small single boat in the middle. And in it stood Jesus and his disciples. And then I saw a massive host of fish just swimming towards the boat, practically throwing themselves on that boat, drawn to the person of Jesus Christ. See, where the state-of-the-art trawlers had sought to succeed in all their strength, they'd ultimately failed. But a simple, small, wooden boat surrendered to the master's use saw the fruits of his labor. When we get tired, when we get worn out, when we worry about how the church will grow, let us remember that Jesus said, I will build my church, and the gates of Hades shall not prevail against it. It's his church. We don't have to worry about fighting the war. He's won it. So this evening, are we fighting our own war? Are we even trying to fight God's war? Are we trying to get God on our side, or are we getting onto his side? See, the battle has already been won in Jesus Christ. Our job is to faithfully proclaim his victory over all powers, in all places, at all times, to all peoples, over every situation of life.